Good morning to most, good afternoon to others, and good evening to the viewing audience across the pond. My name is Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. For all the returning listeners and subscribers, welcome back! So glad to have you here. I hope as soon as you heard the beacon call of the TIR intro, you knew it was time. You're like, oh, they're starting relatively early for a Saturday. You were having a very good off-air conversation. And I was like, not going to do what we usually do, which is start late. Can't do it. Won't do it. A friendly reminder to those that have not done it yet. You might want to set the date June 8th aside on your calendars, because my co-hosts and I are going to be in the capital, Washington, D.C., Beyond the Black Jacobin, C.L.R. James, and the Struggle for Socialism in America, Adolf Reed, the Pascal Robert, Daniel Tutt, Vanessa Willis, Derek Varn. MT calls him my stunt double, Billy Bunton. She's got to stop that. And me. If wherever you are watching or listening to the show, there's links in the description so you can find tickets. If you cannot make it out to DC, that's fine. There's going to be tickets to the live stream of the event as well. So with that being said, let me bring in my co-host, my homie, my dog, the man of the Mau Mau Hour, and a very good Mau Mau Hour, should I add. If you haven't seen it already, check out The Uselessness of Hyperpolitics, Pascal and Daniel Bessner. Please welcome Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings in the chat. Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles.
How are you?
All right. What's up? I'm looking forward to the show.
You know, they're starting off already just messing with me. Did you get your two scoops of Raisin Bran's, Jason? I did not, because they only sell the Mexican Raisin Bran in one place. And I am a bargain shopper even here in Mexico. But rest assured, I did get my extra raisins for said Raisin Bran. I don't know what these people have against raisins, Pascal.
It's racial.
I feel that. I feel that. They, you know, we're not going to get into it because we have a serious show today. But after the serious talk, I will scold you people for talking about my eating habits. Western Sahara, Africa's last colony. While the news headlines are dominated by the stories of student protests on college campuses throughout the country and the state repression of those protests, there's another colonizing narrative that doesn't quite get the same attention. That is the struggle of the Sahrawi people of Western Sahara and their fight against Morocco. The region is rich in phosphorus, as the original colonizing country, Spain, opened a large phosphorus mine in Western Sahara before their decolonization process in the 70s. The indigenous Sahrawi, am I saying it right, Pascal? Sahrawi?
Sahrawi.
Sahrawi people have long sought self-determination, facing significant obstacles from powerful external forces, namely Morocco. The Moroccan annexation of the territory has led to decades of conflict and stalled negotiations, with the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic seeking recognition and autonomy. The ongoing struggle for independence and self-governance is compounded by human rights abuses, displacement, and a humanitarian crisis affecting the Sahrawi people in refugee camps. There is a poignant poem written by Fatma Brahim called Sahara is Not for Sale. The poem was written in the aftermath of Brahim's escape from a refugee camp that was bombed with napalm by the Moroccan Air Force. The Sahara, my brothers and sisters, is not for sale. The green of my land makes me proud as the beauty of its pastures. In the eyes of the good shepherd, the phosphates you desire, they will cause you harm. Not even if they were for sale will you be able to buy them. Bill Fletcher Jr. is a longtime trade unionist, writer, and past president of Trans Africa Forum. He has spent his life in activism, both in the labor movement and the international solidarity sector. Please welcome our guest today, Bill Fletcher Jr.
Thank you, Jason and Pascal.
Thank you for joining us.
Oh, pleasure.
You want to start off with the first question, Pascal?
Absolutely. Not a problem. Bill, I really appreciate you coming out and discussing this very nuanced and sophisticated subject with us. But thank you. I know time is valuable, so we'll get right down to it. What is going on in Western Sahara, and how did Morocco colonize this country in the first place?
So, Western Sahara, in part because of the United States, we're really bad at geography and history. Let me just situate it. It's in the northwest part of Africa. It's south of Morocco, north of Mauritania, west of Algeria and Mali. So it's right on the coast, and a few miles further west are the Canary Islands. It was a territory that was colonized by the Spanish in the 1800s. When the Europeans started dividing up Africa after the Berlin conferences of 1884 and 1885, Spain, which was a weak imperialist power, got only small portions of the continent. They got what now is Western Sahara. They got Equatorial Guinea, what's now Equatorial Guinea, and they got some islands. And basically, that was it. They got a little piece of Morocco. Fast forward, 1975, an independence movement led by an organization called Polisario, that's an acronym, Frente Polisario, the Polisario Front, had been leading a struggle. The Spanish withdrew from Western Sahara in a very haphazard way, in part because Morocco, under then King Hassan II, decided it was going to grab Western Sahara. Now, they did that in part because they wanted to keep people's minds off of the internal turmoil within Morocco. There's a long history to leaders doing things like that. And they set off something that was called the Green March, which was hundreds of thousands of Moroccan settlers, along with Moroccan troops, that stormed into Western Sahara. And at that point, a war broke out. War was between the Sahrawis and the Moroccans and the Sahrawis and the Mauritanians, because Mauritania and Morocco decided they want to get a piece of the pie. The Polisario defeated the Mauritanians, and they've been fine ever since. Morocco kept pushing in and has ultimately occupied 80% of the territory. And their argument is that Western Sahara was always part of what they saw as a greater Morocco. International Court of Justice has said that's not the case, that there's no historical foundation for that. But Morocco sees itself as really entitled to Western Algeria, parts of Mali, Mauritania, and parts of Senegal, as well as Western Sahara. So that's basically the conflict. And the war stopped in 91 based on a truce where the Moroccans agreed that they would hold a referendum on independence. And long story short, when the Moroccans realized they were going to lose the referendum, they basically pulled out. And there was this uneasy peace until November 2020, when the Moroccans broke the truce and the war started again.
And who's arming the Western Sahara people? Who's even helping them get weapons?
Algeria. Okay. So what happened is when the Frente Polisario got started, they weren't getting any help from anybody. But they were able to convince the Algerians and to some extent the Libyans to provide them with assistance. Morocco, on the other hand, has received significant support from France and the United States. And the and that's partly because Morocco is essentially a neo-colony of France. And so the only reason that this war is has been able to continue is that Morocco has all of this military aid. The United States in 91, when the truce was signed, agreed that, you know, that there would be a peaceful resolution to the conflict, but they never pressured the Moroccans to withdraw or abide by agreements the United Nations had come together. So in that sense, it's very similar to the conflict in Palestine, where the United States keeps saying it wants a peaceful solution with negotiations, but they keep arming the Israelis. Oh, by the way, Israel is a very close friend of Morocco and has been since the 1960s.
Are they as helping arm them as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and most recently providing drones. And these drones have been attacking military and civilian targets. So there have been Mauritanians, Algerians, as well as Sahrawis that have been killed by these drones. The Sahrawis keep fighting, and they've even taken some of the fighting into southern Morocco. But the Moroccan government still has an edge. They still have significantly more equipment.
Technologically advanced, obviously, as well with the drone warfare.
Oh, yeah. And surveillance. You know, you've heard of this Pegasus virus?
No.
Are you familiar with that?
No.
Oh, this is something you should probably do a story about. Pegasus is this virus that was created by the an Israeli company, and it's making the rounds within many authoritarian states. And the way it works is that if people open up with their phone attachment that might look legitimate, it releases the virus. And what the virus does is that it basically opens up your phone to everything. So it can access your email, your contacts, all of that. And so the Israelis and the Moroccans have been using Pegasus as a way of clamping down on dissent.
Whoa. Did you know about this, Pascal?
No, I was not aware of the Pegasus virus. That's incredible.
Yeah, look it up, because it's not just the Israelis and the Moroccans using it. It's being used by various repressive states. There's a lot of investigation going on about who's using Pegasus and then trying to figure out ways that people can prevent getting it or getting rid of it. But the key thing is, as they always say, don't open up any attachment unless you know where it's coming from.
Besides phosphorus, what else does Western Sahara possess that would be of value to Morocco?
Fishing.
Okay.
And seafood. Very, very substantial, which is why the Moroccans actually would like to grab the Canary Islands as well. And so phosphates and fishing are two major pieces of what Western Sahara offers. Now, one of the things that's happened is that several multinational corporations have entered into Western Sahara in violation of international law, I might add, to pirate some of these valuable assets that Western Sahara has. Mm-hmm. And as I say, it's a violation of international law. When you have an illegal occupation, an annexation, companies are not supposed to come in and do business unless they have the permission of the native population. And the native population, the Sahrawis, are represented internationally by Polisario, and they have a government in exile that you mentioned, the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic. And so these multinationals shouldn't be doing any business there. And there are international efforts underway and have been to put pressure on the various multinational corporations. And I would refer your viewers and listeners to a site called Western Sahara Resource Watch. Western Sahara Resource Watch that has all kinds of information about who is pirating Western Sahara.
Why has the struggle of the Sahrawi people and the actual conflict of Western Sahara not captured the consciousness of the protesting or activist left in the United States or in the West overall?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that there's several answers. So one answer is that the population is small of Western Sahara, fairly large amount of space, but they're mainly nomadic people. And so it's not like a humongous population. That's one thing. A second thing is that, which really relates to Black America in a certain way, is that this is a conflict within Africa and between African people. And so there's one of these problems that we often have, I'm talking about US African Americans, that when we've looked at Africa, we've been drawn to struggles against white minority rule or against white colonial rule. Okay, South Africa, the former Rhodesia, Portuguese-controlled territories, et cetera. But when it's African against African, we sometimes go sideways. And case in point being the Rwanda genocide, that the Rwanda genocide takes place the same year that South Africa ends apartheid, has a democratic government. And U.S. African Americans were very involved, as you know, in the anti-apartheid movement. We were very, very proud. Same year, though, right-wing Hutus lead a genocide against Tutsis and Hutu allies, where close to 1 million people are murdered within 3 months. And yet there was relative silence within Black America. There were a few exceptions. Randall Robinson, my predecessor and the founder of Trans-Africa Forum, was one of those exceptions that spoke out about this genocide. But there was an amazing amount of quiet. And so that's a second reason. This is African versus African. A third factor is that there's not a significant Moroccan population in the United States or Sahrawi population. But to the extent that Morocco is involved in the United States, it is actually very influential in suppressing discussion of Western Sahara. And I'm talking about influential, including within the Congressional Black Caucus and with various African-American political figures. A final thing is that a lot of people just simply don't know. You know, it's like when you mention Western Sahara, sometimes people think you're just talking about a geography.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in other words, the western part of the Sahara. Mm-hmm. They don't realize that it's actually an occupied territory. So all of those factors exist, which is why several years ago, I and some other people formed the campaign to end the Moroccan occupation of Western Sahara to bring attention to this and to build pressure on the United States to change its policy so that there can be a fully independent and free Sahrawi Republic.
I mean, this kind of reminds me, Pascal, I don't know if you feel the same way, about Haiti. I think you and I were talking yesterday, where I thought the show you and Toussaint did with Dr. Paul McComb on the current situation in Haiti was one of the most informative 90 minutes you could get about the region. And it didn't get a lot of views. And I think it's because people see Haiti as a bit of a backwards country run by corrupt people, but it's backwards inherently almost. And to your point, Bill, when you hear about Africa, I think people are still stuck in 1964 in this kind of, well, we got to decolonize Africa. It's like, well, okay, but you know, it doesn't look the same way it did, you know, when all these Western powers had their thumbs in it. And I don't even know, most people even know where Morocco is on a map.
No, bro. I mean, both your points are so well taken. Let me just say something about Haiti. Mm-hmm. So Haiti has never been forgiven mm-hmm. for kicking Napoleon's ass. Right? I mean, mm-hmm. let's just be real. They kicked the ass of Napoleon, the great Napoleon, forced him to withdraw from Haiti and forced him to sell the United States what was called at that time the Louisiana Purchase. And Haiti was instrumental in supporting revolutions in South America against Spanish colonialism.
Yep.
The United States and France blockaded Haiti. The United States only recognized Haiti in 1862 under Lincoln. And the French demanded reparations from Haiti for Haiti liberating the slaves. And the Haitians paid reparations until 1947. And so you've got that. But as you said, the way that most of us end up seeing Haiti is it's almost like people treat it like it's an embarrassment.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. I even had a discussion. I hesitate to say this, but I had a discussion with this Haitian immigrant who said to me, this was about 20 years ago, what do you do when there's a country where the situation is hopeless? And I looked at her and I said, oh my God, right? So you got all that, but you also have, this is a black country. And even though there are real issues in Haiti around shades of color, let's be very clear about that, and things that the United States introduced when it occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934. But this shades of color, while it's it, but it's black on black. And many black Americans, because of the way that we have been misinformed and miseducated about international issues, we don't know, we often don't know what to do when it's black on black.
Mm-hmm.
And we just like, we'll take a pass.
Well, unfortunately, the reality in Haiti, I'm actually Haitian American, by the way, is that also it's not simply black on black. It's blacks who are compradors with the international ruling class being used by them to suppress the black domestic population. So there is a longstanding internal class component to race, color, and class in Haiti, which is, if you don't understand the nuanced aspects of it, you will think that it's just black on black, but it's really a kind of class reality.
Yes.
And we actually have an international oligarchy of people who have many Arab and Middle Eastern origins that right. complicates the racial narrative of the country in a way that many don't understand. It's like, how is this a country that's supposedly the first black independent nation in the Western Hemisphere, and you have all these Middle Easterners that control 80% of the actual business in the country? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's very not to defend that Haitian comrade, but it's very it's not uncommon for mm-hmm. Haitians to feel hopeless
yeah.
about the situation in the country, because you know, when you are raised in an environment when all you see is negative news for so many years, it's almost impossible in the consciousness of people to see anything positive.
That's right.
And
I think I agree with you, and I really appreciate that analysis and introducing the class aspect to that, which also I will add is something that is absent in the way most of us are trained to look at international issues, including when we look at South Africa and try to figure out what has worked and what has not. And when you go back to the Western Sahara, in part because it's Northern Africa, one other aspect to this, Jason and Pascal, is that we are actually taught that there are two Africas. And that there's sub-Saharan and then there's Northern. And that we as Black Americans should only really be concerned about Southern, because Northern really isn't us. And I reject that line of argument. And I reject it on so many grounds, including just historically, the interconnections that have existed between Northern, Middle, and Southern Africa. And so trying to get people's attention on this is really, really troubling. And I've spoken to politicians about it, trying to get them to understand that this is not an abstraction. The Western Sahara conflict could trigger a regional war, and a regional war that could ultimately drag in France, possibly Spain, and the United States. And so this is not something to just say, oh, yeah, that's interesting. You know, what's the latest in baseball today? You know, it's like we've got to understand the gravity of the situation. And that's leaving all morality aside. I mean, my position on Western Sahara is moral and political. But even if you don't want to engage in the moral part of it, you can say, do you want a Northwest African regional war that could bring the United States in? And I think that the logical answer is hell no.
Well, the next question I wanted to ask you, Bill, is that what does the international community think about the situation? Why don't we see outrage about Africa's last colony? Do you think it has something to do with the colonizing nation being inside Africa and not one of the original European ones?
Yes, absolutely. And it also has to do with a few other things. One is an active lobbying effort by Morocco. What Morocco did, one of the things that they did was that they started going to countries in Africa, particularly, that had recognized the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, which I should add is one of the founding countries of the African Union. When the OAU ended and they formed the African Union, the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic was part of that, and they were part of the founding of this. But the Moroccans have gone to different countries, and they have convinced, using various methods, some countries to revoke their recognition. So the aim there is to isolate Western Sahara. It's very much like the Abraham Accords that Trump started to move to try to get the Arab world to abandon Palestine and thereby strangle the Palestinian movement. The Moroccans are trying to do exactly the same thing. One other aspect to this has to do with spheres of influence, that there is some, as I said before, Morocco is essentially a neo-colony of France. There are some countries that don't want to muck around with Morocco because they see the imprint of France, and they're worried about that. But then there's another factor. The other factor is that not enough hell has been raised about Western Sahara around the world. So if you think about, let's think about South Africa and the anti-apartheid movement. Apartheid gets introduced into South Africa in 1948 when the National Party wins. There begins struggle within South Africa. But the bulk of international attention on South Africa doesn't really happen until the 1960s and then the 1970s. So it took a long time for a global movement to develop. And that's part of what needs to happen right now. We need a global movement that is putting pressure on Morocco. And I would argue that forcing Morocco to change should actually be a lot easier than forcing the apartheid government in South Africa to collapse?
Has there been any sort of like kind of BDS movements for Western Sahara, like you see with Israel Palestine?
Yeah, very limited. There are, as I mentioned before, the Western Sahara Resource Watch has brought to the attention of people various multinational corporations that are doing business in Western Sahara. And in some cases, some companies have been pressured successfully to leave Western Sahara. So this is not a story of gloom and doom. But what has not happened is a concentrated effort that's analogous to BDS on Morocco. And that's where things, as I found out recently, get somewhat complicated. So on the one hand, you'll have people that will make claims or organizations that will say, boycott Morocco. Mm-hmm. Well, that and a couple of bucks will get you across town. That's not the way boycotts work. Boycotts are really an act of war in the sense that you've got to really understand your opponent. You've got to surround them. You've got to strangle them and force them to change. You don't just put out a call. One of the things that I didn't understand is that there's many people in Europe that are actually afraid to go after Morocco because, as you probably know, Morocco is a gate to Europe for refugees. And Morocco is playing the role that Gaddafi was playing with Libya vis-a-vis Europe of saying, I will hold back all of these African migrants from going to Europe if you basically pay me off. And so there's a fear, because every so often what Spain says is, hey, you keep messing with us and we're going to let all these African migrants into Europe. And then these European countries start vibrating, right? And they back down. And that's even affected some supporters of the Sahrawis who are not very sanguine on, let's say, for instance, unsettling the Moroccan economy. Mm-hmm. But they are in favor of putting pressure on multinational corporations, hoping that if you basically get enough of them to withdraw, the Moroccan investment there will effectively collapse. I don't happen to subscribe to that, but that's the argument.
You know, something you said earlier really stuck with me when you said that there's two Africas, right? Mm-hmm. Pretty much the, you know, the dark Africa and the lighter hue. The mocha colored Africa.
Right.
Right.
Oh, right.
And it's fascinating to think about, because as you said that, I'm 46 and I was immediately transported back into the mid to late 80s when the culture industry also too was very vehement about their stance on on boycotting South Africa.
Right.
Right. There was that I'm not going to play Sun City song.
Yeah.
Definitely. It was like a theme in early Spike Lee movies because that was a theme on college campuses. Pascal, you were in school during that time as well. And you said you were Larry Fishburne's character.
I did not play Larry Fishburne's character in school days. I didn't do that.
But is it harder, in your opinions, for African Americans who love claiming Egypt?
Yes.
All the hoteps, we can pull up so many videos of some dude on the Breakfast Club show saying that all black people are kings and they got an Ankh necklace on as big as a
LA. Can I expand your
premise?
I mean, I might ask a bit of an inflammatory question here. I think Bill might be able to think. Are we at a precipice in terms of black American political consciousness where we are so divorced and distanced from the black power internationalism of Pan-Africanism of the late 60s, early 70s, during the anti-colonial era of that period, that the understanding of the concept of Pan-Africanism is divorced from domestic Black consciousness in a way that it's never been before, even going back to the 19th century. Particularly, we see the rise of things like the ADOS movement, where there's an active, almost antagonism to consciousness, to the consciousness that comes around with things like Pan-Africanism.
Yeah. So how long is this podcast? We got another two or three hours.
We got time, brother. This we call this the free show Saturday, so we just go on Saturday.
All right. No, because, I mean, this is critical. So I would say that a few things happened that have resulted in the rise of groups like ADOS. That beginning in the 19, so the high point of national liberation struggles globally was 1979.
Okay.
When the Nicaraguan Revolution succeeded, the Grenadian Revolution succeeded. And by that point, the Portuguese colonies were free. And then we had also struggles in Africa that ultimately resulted in liberation of freedom of Angola and South Africa by 1994. But really, in a lot of ways, the high point was around 1979. And one of the things that starts to unfold largely in the 1980s, in part as a result of the rise of neoliberalism, but only in part, is that there's a crisis in many of the anti-colonial governments. Governments that come after the end of colonialism, the Egypt under, that had been under Nasser, for example, or Mozambique after Samora Machel was killed and after the war against Renamo ended, et cetera. And what you start to see, it goes back a point you were raising, Pascal, is that class struggle is playing out in a lot of these countries in a way that's not to the advantage of the masses of people. And you have the rise of new elites.
The neocolonial bourgeoisie.
Which then becomes at a certain point linked in with what many people call a transnational capitalist class. And even though these folks will often use nationalist rhetoric, they are also very domestically repressive and are advancing very regressive economic and social policies, including what we've just seen, in Uganda with the anti-LGBTQ stuff, in Gambia, et cetera, in Ghana. So part of what's happened is that there's been a retreat from the emancipatory politics of much of the anti-colonial movement and the crisis of the socialist countries as well links in with this. And we've been seeing defeats. And nature abhors a vacuum. And what happens is when this retreat unfolds, we start to see this other kind of politics emerge. And this politics, this right-wing approach that even infects Black America, that argues that usually on an ethno-national basis, we have to cut the best deal we can with imperialism. And ADOS, the American Descendants of Slavery, go further and say that essentially Africa is irrelevant to African Americans. And in fact, we shouldn't even call ourselves African Americans. We should call ourselves freedmen. We're really Americans. So they want to make a complete break with the rest of the African world. And try to find a place within a neo-apartheid United States. So I think to a great extent, we're engaged in fighting what a lot of the rest of the world's fighting, right-wing ethno-nationalist politics, where people are in effect trying to find peace with imperialism to the exclusion of all else. So you see the rise of xenophobia, for instance, in South Africa, where a country that had sent refugees and migrants throughout the continent during apartheid, then after the end of apartheid, when African migrants are coming to South Africa, in part because the wealth gap has never been closed in South Africa, you end up getting the xenophobic thing. We don't want Zimbabweans here. We don't want Malawians here. We don't want Mozambicans here. And things just start going to hell. And so this is part of what we're up against. And it actually relates to then going back to Western Sahara, which is where people will say, why should I care about what's happening in Western Sahara? You know, and even Jason, you know, it's funny when you were saying about Egypt. So many African Americans will look at Egypt with pride, but increasingly you find people saying, well, I'm not going to look at Egypt exactly. I'm going to look at the black folks in the southern part of Egypt, mm-hmm. and, you know, the Nubians, and take pride in them as if there was some tremendous wall between the Nubians and everyone else. And if you go to North Africa, which I have once, I was in Tunisia and Egypt, I looked around. I'll say when I was in Tunisia, it's the only time in my life where I didn't feel like I stood out. And I saw people, all shades of the rainbow, that were there. And a lot of us think of North Africa as Elizabeth Taylor or something.
Is that the failure, though, of the way that we historicize race in America as well? Yes. Like, we have this idea that it's always binary. Been race first. You know,
notion is a very sick binary notion of black, white that we have that comes out of the United States. It affects how we look at places like Haiti.
That's right.
That very much taint the ability to make analysis in foreign international realities. And you combine that with the lack of class analysis, and it makes the prism from which the American lens looks at the world very skewed and very difficult to get to any crux of truth.
That's right.
Would you say that's the problem with 1619?
It is a problem with the 1619 project. And I'm not jumping on them, attacking them at all. But you see, the thing about it, and it relates to these novels that I've written, which I'll get into in a second, is that in order to understand race in the United States, you cannot just look at the African-American experience. You have to look at the experience of the indigenous. You have to look at the experience of the Mexicans who were captured. You have to look at the Chinese, Japanese, and Filipinos. You've got to look at Hawaii. You've got to look at Micronesia. You've got to look at Puerto Rico. And so when you restrict it to African-Americans as defining black versus whites, then you get into real problems. See, I wrote these two novels in the last few years. The first one is called The Man Who Fell from the Sky, and the second is called The Man Who Changed Colors. And they're murder mysteries. About race, class, revenge, and Cape Verdean Americans. Now, most people in the United States not only don't know much about Western Sahara, they don't know much about Cape Verdeans. So you mentioned Cape Verdeans, and they'll look at you like you just started speaking
in tongues,
right? And so Cape Verde, the archipelago, is 500 miles off the coast of West Africa. And the Cape Verdeans were the first people of African descent post-1492 to come to the United States voluntarily. First, in the 19th century, they did not come as slaves. They came on whaling ships and fishing ships, and they came as subjects of Portuguese colonialism. And part of the reason I decided to do this relates to what you were raising, Pascal. When you look at the Cape Verdean experience here, it shows how complicated race is and that it doesn't break down very easily, because Cape Verdeans are all shades of the rainbow. They came here speaking Portuguese or Criollo. They were mainly Catholic, and they had not been slaves. And they encountered this population of African descent that were overwhelmingly the descendants of slaves, Protestant and English speaking. And so there was this real challenge in terms of the way these populations interacted up until actually fairly recently. And that's what I cover in the first book. And so a lot of the way that we treat race is very narrow. So it's very hard for U.S. African Americans to not only understand Haitians, but Lord knows to understand Latinos. Mm. And so because of the Spanish system of white supremacy, premised on this notion that was called Las Castas, you have all of these breakdowns that are not replicated in the United States. When you go to Africa, I've been to Africa a number of times, and you see what I look like. Mm-hmm. And so when I go there, and when I've been to Latin America, people will sometimes say, well, Bill, what are you? And if I say I'm Black, that starts a whole interesting discussion, which I ultimately turn into a joke, right? Because I'll say to people, well, you have an unclarity as whether I'm Black. But if I land in New York and I say I'm anything other than Black, I'll be put in a straitjacket and taken to an insane asylum. So why is that? Which opens up incredible discussions. So when we're looking at Western Sahara or looking at North Africa, this is Africa. This is the complexity of Africa that included migrations from the Arab world, and some migrations from Europe, migrations from southern parts of Africa up. It's very complicated and does not break down in the way that we largely understand race in the United States.
Pascal, you want to add to that?
No, I think I can echo that absolutely. And I would argue that one of the locations within the United States that challenged that kind of binary is where some of our friends of the shores are from, Louisiana. You will find that most African-Americans are stuck in that kind of back. For example, you try to get someone who's from Chicago and Detroit to look at how race works in a place like Louisiana with the Creoles there, they'll be confused.
It confused me. When I went to work in the Gulf of Mexico, it was very confusing.
Yes.
That was in the mid-aughts, and they still had segregated proms.
Right.
And there were people about as dark as Bill that were white.
Oh, yeah.
And that kind of stuff. I'm from California. White people are all the same where I'm from, allegedly. And then I went to the South and saw a whole different world that definitely informed my political views of the world. And it is kind of maddening, when you see people that have to see it through this racial binary. It's like you kind of want to take them to the bayou for a day.
Jason, let me just point out something that's in the chat that's very important.
Oh, don't look in the chat, Bill.
Oh, no, but this actually, it's a really good historical point. Because someone says some of the earliest Africans to come to America came in Spanish ships, and they weren't slaves, but indentured servants like most Europeans who made it to America at that time. The writer is raising a very important point, but it's a little bit more complex than what the writer said, that the Spanish ships that came over often had Moors on them as soldiers and sailors. The Moors were the North African population that controlled the Iberian Peninsula, mostly the Iberian Peninsula, for about 700 years. And then after 1492, were subjugated by the Castilians under Isabella and Ferdinand, the Castilians in Aragon. But there were Moorish mercenaries that came over. That's true. There were also indentured servants. That is, that the British particularly brought over to North America Africans as indentured servants. That is true, but they did not come voluntarily. That's a distinction I'm making with the Cape Verdeans. The Africans did not go down to the shores of Senegal and say, I'd like to book passage to New York. They were captured, but they were brought over as both slaves and indentured servants. And the writer is correct. By the end of the 1600s, indentured servitude for Africans was eliminated as part of a mechanism of social control over Africans and over Europeans. Now, that will take us down a whole other road, but I wanted to just respect what the person wrote there.
Pascal, you want to add anything to that?
That's a very good point. I appreciate clarifying that.
We should have called this the Hotep's Gonna Be Mad at Us show. We just could have taken that as a title.
Some people want, it's very difficult for people to be divorced from the concepts they have that are preconceived that limit their ability to see the world clearly. I mean, it's just world is more complicated than simply what we see on the shores of North America.
Exactly. And you know, going back to the Rwanda thing, I can't forgive so many of our leaders for being silent about the Rwanda genocide. And I also find it very troubling that the Congressional Black Caucus has been silent on Western Sahara. I've gone to the Congressional Black Caucus, by the way, to talk with them about Western Sahara. And sort of naively, I thought, well, you know, this should resonate with them. This is, you know, an act of aggression against an African people, and this violates international law. You know, I figured that they'd get with that. And nope. Some of them got with it, but nope. You know, I mean, you know, when the Congressional Black Caucus has its annual gatherings in September, you would think that one of the things that they would focus on in terms of foreign policy is, well, like, what's the state of Africa? And let's look at Western Sahara. Let's look at the ongoing challenges that Ethiopia has. What do we do about Somalia? What about the Democratic Republic of the Congo and this horrific situation going on since the 90s? What some people have called Africa's First World War. You know, what do we do? And we don't get leadership from the Congressional Black Caucus on this. And I think that's horrendous.
Yeah, but I mean, Bill, you listen, you're not unfamiliar with the analysis of the Black political class and what the Black political class has been reduced to in the post-civil rights era. And, you know, some don't like this metaphor. I know Adolf Reed is not a fan of it, but you know, likening them to the comprador neo-colonial bourgeoisie of Africa, and that in terms of that, their main functionality is to maintain a kind of captured Black politics where they act as brokers for the majority of Black people. I've said this millions of times on this Revolution podcast, in exchange for patronage from the corporate elite. So the notion that there's any sense of radicalism simply because of the Congressional Black Caucus we're beyond that point, frankly.
Well, Pascal, I would both agree and disagree with you. I think in some ways, your critique is too sweeping. Not that it's wrong, it's a little bit too sweeping. I think that while it's true, what you describe is absolutely the case for specific members of the caucus, and I'm not going to name names. But I think that there's another factor, which is that I don't want this to sound arrogant, but many of these folks don't get international affairs at all. They are very domestically focused. Very. There was even one former member of the CVC I spoke with a number of years back, who very progressive and knew some stuff about Western Sahara, but was not going to speak up, largely because in their words, there was no constituency in their district that really gave a damn about Western Sahara. And this person was being pressured around other issues. And so I think that part of what we're looking at, man, is like, part of it is what you're saying. I'm not going to walk away from that. But part of it is also the larger problem of living in the United States and thinking you don't have to really pay attention to the rest of the world. You just don't. And that you can get away with focusing on the US. Now there's one other aspect to this, which is really nefarious, which is this very successful lobbying of the Moroccans. They have been very successful. And one of the people that they have reached out to over the years, and it's always astonished me, has been the Reverend Jesse Jackson, that they have reached out to on a regular basis, inviting him over there for trips and things like that. And given how progressive Jackson has been over the years, including on international issues such as Palestine, I would have expected something else. So I think all I would say, bro, is that I would add to your analysis. I'd make it a little bit more nuanced.
I appreciate that. Well, let's give you some follow-up questions about the situation that's going on in Western Sahara.
Sure.
Can you explain the conflict between Algeria and Spain over Western Sahara?
Ah. So Algeria fought a war of liberation from 1954 to 1962. And they were able to create base areas in Tunisia and Morocco. And that's a whole other story. When Algeria became free, Morocco decided that it wanted to seize large portions of Western Algeria. And a mini war broke out. Some people would call it a border clash. And relations between Algeria and Morocco have never been good since. The relations at some points have been better, other times worse. But when Algeria decided to support the independence of Western Sahara, all bets were off as far as Morocco was concerned. And so it's gotten really bad. So you have things like forest fires in Western Algeria that the Algerian government attributes specifically to the Moroccans, that what the Moroccans are doing is what the Japanese did during World War II when they sent balloons over the United States to create forest fires in the West. And so you've got that. And so you've got that level of tension. Now, Spain has been, I would argue, been playing a really terrible role. First of all, they violated United Nations directions in terms of what a country is supposed to do when it decolonizes. And so instead of allowing the Sahrawis to choose their own future, the Spanish just simply got out of the way of the Moroccans and allowed the Moroccans to invade Western Sahara. They did not militarily prevent the Moroccans. And part of that was that the Moroccans, King Hassan, was very, very slick. He basically put all these civilians in front and Moroccan troops behind the civilians. So it was Moroccan civilians that were walking into Western Sahara. At that point, it was called Spanish Sahara. So that if the Spanish tried to stop this invasion, they were going to have to kill all these Moroccan civilians. It was very, very slick. And so the Spanish then just threw up their hands and withdrew. The Spanish actually still have an obligation from international law for Western Sahara, because Western Sahara is there's a UN term for it, but basically is a non-self-governing territory, just like Occupy Palestine. And so the Spanish are supposed to have a role in this, but they basically, you know, as far as the Spanish are concerned, no one's here but us chickens. The Spanish government, that is.
Wow. So can you explain the basis for the Algerian support for the Polisario Front and its bid for independence and how that issue has made bedfellows of Spain and Morocco?
The Algerians were initially not jumping up and down about supporting Polisario. They weren't really sure what they thought about Polisario. But eventually, then Algerian President Boumediene became convinced that it was a legitimate struggle. Now, the Moroccans would argue that the Western Sahara, the Polisario, is a proxy for Algeria. And there's no foundation for that. Polisario was formed in 1973, if I'm not mistaken. And they carried on this fight initially without much help from anybody. And Algeria at that time was supporting anti-colonial struggles. There were base areas and training for liberation forces that were fighting the Portuguese, fighting against white minority rule. There was a Panther office in Algiers for years. And so I would argue that the Algerian involvement was, at least initially, an expression of solidarity. Now, over the years, has that changed? Possibly. It's hard for me to say. But the Algerians have stuck with the Polisario. The Spanish obviously have not. And this has created tension between Spain and Algeria. And one of the things is that Algeria has been the major gas producer for Spain. And Algeria is not very sanguine about continuing to provide gas. I believe that they cut it off and are shipping it now through Italy to Europe. So this becomes a real economic problem, among other things, for the Spanish. So there does need to be pressure on the Spanish. The French are the ones that provide more comprehensive aid to Morocco.
Why is that?
Because they want to keep Morocco in their pocket. And if they turn on Morocco, they could have a situation like we see in Niger or Chad, well, not Chad, Niger or Mali, where these coup governments have thrown the French out. The French do not want to be thrown out of Africa. And Morocco is very important to them. Morocco is also very important to the United States because of things like extraordinary rendition, where prisoners would be shipped to Moroccan jails. Morocco has a terrible human rights record, and they might be interrogated there as they were in Syria, believe it or not. And so when Trump recognized the Moroccan annexation of Western Sahara, which no other country had done until now, Israel has, this was a violation of international legal precedent. But Morocco was a key ally for the United States.
That was my next question. Next question I was to ask you is, former United States President Donald Trump shocked many observers when in December of 2020, his administration broke with years of international consensus to recognize Morocco's claim to the disputed territory of Western Sahara. The move, which came in the context of a normalization deal between Israel and Morocco, made Washington the first Western power to explicitly recognize Rabat's claim to the west, the vast region, bucking the United Nations official designation of Western Sahara as a non-self-governing territory. That's right. Now, has the Biden administration taken any effort to reverse Trump's policy decision in that region?
Man, I wish I could say yes, but the answer is no. But let's go back to what Trump did. It's really interesting. So we talked before about the Abraham Accords. These were these supposed peace treaties between Israel and various Arab countries. Now, there was no war going on between these Arab countries and Israel. So there were no peace treaties that needed to be signed. But these were normalization agreements, and they were all aimed at isolating the Palestinians. Now, when it comes to Morocco, what I mentioned in passing earlier is that the relationship between Morocco and Israel goes back to the 1960s, mm-hmm. when there was collaboration between the Israeli Mossad, you know, their international, their version of the CIA, and the Moroccan secret police. That relationship has been ongoing. There was nothing that the Abraham Accords brought that was necessary. In other words, it wasn't like there needed to be these accords in order for Israel and Morocco to get along. But one thing that seems to have motivated Trump is, as we all know, Trump is very vindictive, and he was very upset with one of his key allies, then Senator Inhofe out of Oklahoma, who had disagreed with Trump on a specific item, a budget item. I think it was around military issues. And, you know, Inhofe had been down the line supporting Trump. But on this thing, he didn't. And what many observers have said is that Trump recognized the annexation as a way of slapping his face at Inhofe. Now, why Inhofe? This becomes a really interesting story. This Republican was a strong supporter, he's still alive, but he's no longer a senator. Strong supporter of the Sararis.
Really?
Yes. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. Here's the roots of it. Well, actually, I'll get to that in a second. Let me just say, in terms of your question about Trump, about Biden, when Biden entered into office, most of us thought that he would reverse this. He didn't. And we and other people have continued to put pressure on the administration. And the answer we get back is something like, well, we're really afraid of antagonizing Israel if we reverse this, and it might lead Morocco to leave the Abraham Accords.
Wow.
Right? So there's no basis to believe Morocco would leave the Abraham Accords. None. But worrying about this, as opposed to worrying about international law, you know, little things like that, that's what's motivating them. Now, they haven't proceeded as quickly as Trump would have. And if Trump gets back into office, he will, I'm sure, in terms of setting up full consular office and everything else. But the roots of this thing with Republicans are fascinating. And it goes back to, in the 1990s, the UN Secretary General asked former Secretary of State James Baker, who had been Secretary of State under George H.W. Bush, he was a Republican, to serve as an intermediary on the resolution of the Sahrawi conflict. So he came in representing the Secretary General and was involved in negotiations with the Polisario and with the Moroccan royalty. And he came up with a couple of different solutions. Didn't work. And ultimately came up with an agreement that Polisario said, okay, we'll go with it. It wasn't ideal, but they said they would go with it. The Moroccans initially were going to go for it. And then they counted the numbers, and they didn't like the numbers. And they withdrew and said, henceforth, there will be no referendum that includes independence as an option. A referendum will only include autonomy or annexation. That's it. Well, at that point, James Baker threw up his hands. And I remember watching a PBS documentary on this years ago. And Baker basically said he threw up his hands. He was completely humiliated by what the Moroccans did. And at that point, what opened up was, in effect, a blood feud between Baker and his allies and acolytes and the Moroccans. And it exists to this day. You might remember the name John Bolton.
Yeah, of course.
Right? John Bolton has never been known as a socialist, a Bolshevik, a revolutionary. Right? Not as far as, I mean, not in Wikipedia, right? But Bolton, believe it or not, is a strong supporter of Sahrawi independence. Why? Baker. These people that were around Baker were so furious with the Moroccans. I've read things that Inhofe has said and written about Western Sahara. You'd think the guy was a Marxist.
Wow.
Seriously. I mean, it's like, it's unbelievable. And my campaign includes, my co-chair is a Republican, believe it or not. I mean, it's like, I'm an open Marxist. Everybody knows I'm on the left. Everybody. And my co-chair is... there is no daylight between us when it comes to Western Sahara. We just can't talk about other issues, right? But that's one of the odd things about this circumstance. And so you get people like Inhofe, right? So when the argument is that part of what Trump did, because he's such a vindictive person, yes, was he did this to slap Inhofe, to punish Inhofe for having gotten out of line with fearless leader.
Can I ask you a question? And if you don't want to answer, that's fine. Do you ever get a pushback from people because of your co-chair being a Republican, that it's, yes, some sort of red-brown alliance that you have?
Yes. Yes, I do. And this is not a red-brown alliance. I know what a red-brown alliance is. This is a, how can I put this? This is, to a great extent, the result of who has been on the side of Polisario all these years, mm-hmm, who is not. Mm-hmm. And sometimes politics creates strange bedfellows, but you have to always be careful that the terms of the relationship do not allow you to be cut in your throat or otherwise silenced. And so one of the things, and I appreciate the question, Jason, one of the things that happened with one organization that we approached to do some work with. I don't want to go into a lot of details, but they refused to work with us. And they said because of some of the people that were associated with us. And I pointed out that in the anti-apartheid movement in the United States, there were Republicans mm-hmm. that were involved. I mean, it wasn't just like Marxist-Leninists, right? It was, you know what I mean? It was like, it wasn't just black nationalists. There were white and black Republicans that were on the side of the anti-apartheid movement. And so the question is what are the terms and what are you aligning around? So for instance, as much as I respect my co-chair, that's one of the reasons we don't talk about other things, because we're not going to agree on so much else. And I'm not going to be apologizing for her. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's just, we're going to have differences. You know, I'll give you another example. Years ago, I was involved in an effort. We were trying to get an effort off the ground to get Curt Flood into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Now, for those of your listeners and viewers that don't know who Curt Flood was, he was this outstanding St. Louis Cardinals outfielder who was to be traded by the Cardinals to the Philadelphia Phillies in the late 1960s. And he refused to be traded because there was a system that they had then called the reserve clause. And it was very much like indentured servitude, where you were owned by a team until you retired or until they let you go. And Curt Flood said, I don't want to go to Philly. My home is St. Louis. And he refused to go, and he took his case to court. He got the support of the Major League Baseball Players Association, went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and in one of the most bizarre rulings in Supreme Court history, they found against Curt Flood and in favor of Major League Baseball. Now, but the effect of this lawsuit so shook up baseball that Major League Baseball was, the Major League Baseball Players Association under Marvin Miller was able to devise this brilliant strategy that broke the reserve clause and opened up free agency, which is why you now have players that can make zillions of dollars. It's not because they're great. It's because of the courage of people like Curt Flood and Marvin Miller and the Players Association. So I was involved in this effort to try to get Curt Flood into the Hall of Fame. He died in 1997. And we were talking about it. And I said, you know who we need to enlist? George Will.
Mm. Yeah, I'm not George Will. Big baseball aficionado.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, George Will and I have about as much in common as I do with a Romulan. Right? But while we can disagree on foreign policy and everything, right? George Will is a fanatic baseball supporter and, ironically, a supporter of the Major League Baseball Players Association. He takes the side of the players. So I said to this group, I said, if we're going to move this campaign, we need to get George Will on our side. Now, clearly, we're going to disagree with George Will on a whole host of things, but those things are not what we're debating right now. What we're debating right now is whether Curt Flood should go into the Hall of Fame. And if we can align on that and not cut each other's throats, then let's go forward. But that doesn't excuse anything, and it doesn't mean I'm going to apologize for George Will on other things. So we're working, Jason, we're walking this very fine line. But some people, they can't accept it. And truth be told, I don't know how long this will be able to last.
It feels like tribalism to a certain degree when you think, especially now, I don't know if through this lens of social media, which is usually the way people see the political world, we become even more tribal. You know, to kind of even add this on to your point about George Will, a very famous conservative commentator that's also been a pretty also well-known baseball writer, right? What is his name? Ted Nugent. Mm-hmm. Longtime guitar playing virtuoso, also far right, gun toting, Trump supporting. For the most part, he says some pretty racist and horrible things. Was the first person I saw to come out against the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame chair member that had said in a book that black people and women didn't belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame because they didn't really contribute to the genre.
Right.
And it was Nugent that was like one of the first people to say, hey, what are you talking about here? Like literally everything I learned on this instrument is from these people. And you know, I like your point. Like I can't defend everything Ted Nugent says and I won't.
Right.
But he was on the right side on that statement.
And you have to then make a decision because sometimes this becomes a tactical matter because sometimes people might be on the right side, but they are so screwed up. You just don't want, I mean, it's like they don't bring anything to the table and they'll contaminate the issue. So, but that's not a matter of principle. That is a tactical assessment that has to be made. But this organization that I mentioned earlier that wouldn't work with us, I pleaded with them. I said, look, they know who I am and they're willing to work with me. And they said, they know who you are? I said, yes. I mean, among other things, these days with the internet, that's not too difficult, right? but they know who I am. But I couldn't budge them. So I left it alone.
That's rough.
Yeah, it was very painful.
Pascal?
No, it's a fascinating discourse. But I mean, you know, in politics, politics does have strange bedfellows. But as long as you stick to your principles and you make sure you know who you're getting in bed with, I mean, I know that there are people who had many disagreements about a variety of things in recent political history that have caused major fracturing on the left in terms of what to support, what direction to go. I know Bernie Sanders was one of those examples of something that caused major division to allies in terms of people from everything going from Barack Obama to all types of things. Mm-hmm. So I think that people have their principles. I mean, one of the things about people on the left is unfortunately because leftists don't seem to have a lot of material success, and there's not a lot of material things to cling to. What they tend to cling to with their ideological principles. And sometimes that clinging doesn't allow them to allow nuance in areas that may have to make concessions.
Would you brothers say this? Look, Pascal, you and I, for the most part, are pundits, right? We're part of a chattering class, if you really want to be honest about it. We don't have to make political affiliations. It's not part of what we do. As a matter of fact, it's probably antithetical to what we do. So we can just say whatever the hell we want to say about whoever we want to say. We want to call AOC a traitor. We can do 5 shows on it. It doesn't make a difference. We don't have to make any sort of strange bedfellows with anybody because we live in the world of critique. And it feels like everybody wants to live in the world of critique.
Yeah.
And no one wants to understand the nuance that Bill is talking about.
I find that has been an evolving problem that has gotten worse with the advent of the internet.
Yes.
And also really starts with the rise of cable news, quite honestly, and the proliferation of opinion and the diminution of actual reporting. That starts in the 90s with the rise of cable television and cable news, where you have a lot of just kind of opinion television that starts to take hold, and it gets worse with the advent of the internet. And there's truth to what you're saying, Jason, that, you know, we're living in the world of critique, and I think it takes away from the actual agency of those who are interested in actually doing the work of building something. And one of the problems that I've said this to you before on the show is that one of my major problems with us on the left is that we are always stuck in critique, but very few of us are interested in building something. And I think it's one of the main faults that we have is that those of us who look at us on the left as challenging is that it's very easy to open us to criticism. And we say, well, what have you built that actually gives an institutional...
But to build things like an institution, you have to want people to come in to your institution. And what happens when you don't, you may say you want to build an institution, but you really want to build a monument to yourself.
That's right.
You know, my friend Alex Herbert and I, Professor Alex Herbert and I, are working on this book, and we're almost done with the preface that we're going to publish. Hopefully it should be out next week. And we're using punk rock as an example. And I wrote my pamphlet, I Was a Teenage Anarchist, kind of on this same principle, that these musical genres that people think are, oh, this is leftist because this guy said this and this guy said that, these are really individualistic. You know, Vincent Bevins talks about this in the conclusion to his book, If We Burn, about all these political movements that happened in the 2010s, these massive protests, and nothing happens. Because a lot of them are based off of this horizontalism. A lot of them come out of punk, and it's extremely individualistic. So what happens when your leftism is as neoliberal as the world you live in, and you really can't see beyond it? We always talk about capitalist realism. What about neoliberal realism?
That's right.
Where you now you have a neoliberal leftism, and we forget that if you put a tweet out or post, whatever the hell you do on social media, and people echo that thing, 100 people like it and retweet it, and maybe it's gone viral, because viral is a relative term now in 2024. Doesn't mean what it used to mean 20 years ago. So you feel like you're part of a community, but you're not out there building community. Back to the church thing. You're not building a church and looking for people to come in. And if you are, everybody's building a church. No one wants to be a parishioner. Everybody wants to be the priest.
This is so fundamental. I'd actually love to come back, not to invite myself, but I will.
Yeah, no, you please, please.
This has been a good... talk about this in depth, because it's a lot of what I grapple with. And that book by Bevan, it's incredible. It's really incredible. Is a difference between strategy and ideology, and a difference between strategy and tactics. And there's also what you're describing, Jason, about critique. So I was on a podcast a few months ago, and I got run over the coals by someone, and I realized afterwards that they basically wanted to score points. They weren't actually interested in discussing strategy, the strategic implications of different things. They wanted to score points, and they wanted to show how pure they were as leftists. And I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in winning. And one of the things about winning is that it gets messy. That's something perhaps because of my experience in the trade union movement, knowing that in a union, you have people with all kinds of views, and you're trying to build a block at some point to influence what that union does and how it relates to the outside world. And that gets messy. So it means that you sometimes have to deal with racists, sexists, homophobes. You got to figure out how to deal with them, who you can win over, who you can't, who you isolate. I mean, there's all of these questions, and there's not enough of that discussion. And in the aftermath of the 2020 uprisings and demonstrations, and it relates very much to Bevan's book. We have built very little, and worse, we opened up a hole that the right wing has been going into as part of the counterattack. One of the things that really influenced my thinking was understanding the growth of what came to be called the new right, which was the far right elements that had come out of the Goldwater campaign in 64. Mm-hmm. And people like Viguerie and Weyrich. And these folks wanted to build a much harder right. And so they had to make certain decisions. So one decision was whether to form a third party, because they didn't like the Republican Party. And too many liberals, as far as they were concerned. But then they decided to go the strategy of working inside and outside of the Republican Party. And they created alliances, including with people that they despised, like Richard Nixon, because they viewed Nixon as a liberal. He wasn't far enough to the right, but Nixon was willing to ally with them and provide them with an opening. But then they started to do other things. They started to build their own institutions, like the Heritage Institute, and other groupings that became right-wing think tanks and training grounds for people who had a hard right-wing view. And they did most of this very quietly. And so over a period of time, the other thing that they did is help to build right-wing mass movements, anti-busing movement, anti-Panama Canal treaty movement, anti-abortion movement. And in each of these movements, they made the price of entrance very low. So to get into the anti-busing movement, you didn't have to be anti-abortion. You could be pro-abortion. To get into the anti-abortion movement, you didn't have to be pro-guns. You just had to be anti-abortion. See, much on the left, we keep raising the bar. It's not enough for people to agree on a particular issue. Then you have to ask, well, what's your position on North Korea?
Always having to have the right take, if you will. And then I do put this blame on social media, because our opinions get to get voiced. And again, we get to get that dopamine rush of people saying, hey, you're right on this. When Russia-Ukraine broke out, it felt like there was hysteria on the right take. Mm-hmm. And this is going to sound horrible. I feel like a reason why everybody jumps in now on the Israel-Palestine thing, and I want to preface this by saying it's a beautiful thing to see.
Yeah.
So many people finally admitting that there is humanity in the lives of Palestinian people, right? I have to acknowledge that every time I say this. But the good guys and bad guys are just so easy for people to see and understand. We were talking about Haiti earlier today. No one wants to talk about Haiti. No one wants to talk about sub-Saharan Africa.
Right.
No one wants to talk about Myanmar. Right. You think there's not millions of refugees that we will see from these displacements?
That's right.
But if you don't know where the good guy is, you don't have the right take, then there's a fear, another word people don't like, of being canceled.
That's right.
And that's scary, because, again, when we talk about discourse, when we talk about building movements, how then, and this isn't a rhetorical question, how then can you build something when people are so afraid of saying the wrong thing? If you don't know enough about Marx to be part of a leftist organization. There is elitism in a lot of contemporary leftism, in my opinion.
Well, part of the problem is that a lot of the left is nothing but a nerd social study club.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, But you know, the other part of this is that over the last 30 years, and I wrote something about this, I'm going to try to get published, the notion of safe space has evolved in a way that's not good. So in the 90s, when people would talk about creating a safe space, it was usually in an educational setting or organizing setting where you want to create a situation where people are not being judged and where people could make mistakes without being jumped on. And that you guarantee that. You basically say, look, this is a safe space. But what's happened over time is that that term has evolved into a space where I don't feel uncomfortable. And what that ends up meaning is that if I raise something that disagrees with something you just said, and you don't like it, you can say, well, Bill's not making me feel comfortable. He's making me feel very uncomfortable. Now, the right wing, like DeSantis, take that, and then they pass laws to prevent the discussion of race because it makes white people feel uncomfortable. But anytime, but it happens in the left, anytime you introduce new ideas, because truth always begins in the minority. But that doesn't mean the minority is always truthful. But it always begins in the minority. And in education, it's going to be uncomfortable. I'll give you an example of something that just really sticks in my mind. So a few years ago, I got called in by this organization to do a racial justice training. So I'm working with the staff, and this one staff member says something like this. Well, I know that this whole notion of white privilege was created or invented by this white woman back in the 90s, but it's still an important idea. So I looked at the person and I said, well, that's actually not true. The notion of white privilege, you could actually take it back to Lenin and the notion of national privilege, right? But certainly white privilege or white skin privilege was being discussed in the 1960s and 70s, and it wasn't invented in the 1990s. So this person looked at me in, they were stunned and horrified. And I didn't think anything of it. I mean, I didn't call them an ass, right? I didn't say, what are you, nuts, right? I just corrected them. All right, so the next training, the next time in the training, before the training got started, one of the senior staff people said, Bill, before we get started, we just need to tell you that some of the staff were upset with you. I said, why? They said, well, the way you dealt with such and such. And I said, but why? I mean, she was incorrect. I said, yeah, but people thought that you really should have validated her more. I said, what was I supposed to say? Oh, that's a really profound point, except it's wrong. I mean, what was I supposed to say? And I realized at that point that that increasingly we got this idea that my opinion is as legitimate as your facts. And this takes us down a very, very bad road.
That's a very good point.
It's an issue that is an uncomfortable one. Because feeling victimized allows you to speak out.
That's right.
And if you can only find your power in feeling victimized, that says a lot about a defeated moment.
Yes.
And you can't build anything off defeat, in my opinion.
That's right.
I don't know if you guys, if you feel the
same. No, absolutely. But you see, there's a lot of us that are cool with defeat. In fact, we're so used to defeat, all we want is a glorious defeat. We've given up on the idea that we can win. But if we can go down gloriously, that's cool. So if we go into an election and a fascist wins, we can say, well, at least I stuck to my principles, even though I'm going into a concentration camp. But at least I stuck to my principles. And so you get this, you get people abandoning the idea of winning, because the problem with winning is that it's messy.
It also requires accountability.
It does. Ooh. It really does.
Ooh.
So it's much easier to throw stones, rocks, to score points, and to feel good about yourself until the day comes when you get walked into a camp.
Is that why people retreat to academia?
I think that it's, yes. The short answer is that some people, not all people, obviously, some people go into academia to retreat. Some go in for other really positive reasons. But the problem is, when you are in academia, to paraphrase Clint Eastwood, a person's got to be aware of their own limitations. Mm. Well, you've got to be aware that when you're in academia, you have a certain privileged environment. And even if the administration comes down on you, there are, certainly if you're tenured, amazing protections that you have, that people on the outside who are carrying on the daily battles that don't have that are in a completely different situation. Mm-hmm. And there are academics who will go nameless, who often think that they can say whatever they want. There's no consequence. They don't have to worry about strategy because they can stand on principle because of their academic status. They can say whatever they want. They don't have to worry about winning because at the end of the day, you can go back to academia.
We did a show, Pascal. I don't know if you remember this. Oh, God. Maybe 3 years ago with a French scholar. And this person just told us or asked us if we could privatize the show because there's so much criticism right now of teachers that this person is scared they're going to lose their job.
Mm-hmm. Are you serious?
Yeah. Yeah. I have to go. When we're done here, I got to go put the show on private. Yeah.
I know who you're talking about.
Yeah.
It kind of blew my mind getting that message.
But see, I remember in the, I want to say 1997, 1998, I gave a talk at some college, and I was active in the labor movement. And one of the speakers was a professor who basically said, well, I'm tenured, and so I have very little to worry about. Now, there were interesting things about the comment. One is that I appreciated them saying that. What I think that they should have said is, I have nothing to worry about right now. But when we look at the trajectory of politics and the economy, that's not so certain. Mm-hmm. So when you look at technology, when you look at the growth of contingent workers and faculty, people have a lot to worry about. But then when you look at repression and repression increasing, people have a lot to worry about. But even within that, you know, it's like, who died last when the Titanic went down? People on the upper decks, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in many cases, they had a chance to survive. Those people in steerage didn't. And I look at some folks in academia and I think they're on upper decks. I'm not faulting them for that. I'd love to be in academia. I'd love to teach. I love teaching. But it's not an eternal safe space. It might give you a little bit more room.
Oh, definitely not with the rise of the neoliberalization of higher
adjuncts.
That's right.
Then we go to the majority of the professors at many of these universities anyway.
I think Mesner said that on the show the other day, yeah.
Yeah, no, this is a real, real problem. Declining tenure, more contingent, and people having to assemble. This is one reason I ended up ultimately not going that direction. It was like, you have to assemble jobs. You know, the Mike Davis, the noted writer, California, deceased now, unfortunately, he's a great guy. Before he got his doctorate and then tenure, I mean, he was telling me, I mean, he had to like jump around from college to college in order to survive, you know, in terms of teaching. I don't mean like spending 1 year in one place. I mean,
semester,
working during the same semester, having multiple schools he was teaching in order to make a living. And that's increasingly becoming the way it's going.
But my good friend, who also does this, Ben Burgess, his contract at a school in Los Angeles is coming up, and he's got to hustle to find another gig.
Right.
You know, it's semester to semester for these people. And I think people look at there's this way that people are looking at cats that work in academia. Well, you live in these hallowed halls. It's like only a few people have tenure.
Only a few.
It's not what you think it is. And some of the people that have tenure don't make that much money.
That's right.
You know, Gene Bajlan on this show isn't a millionaire. Isn't even close. Isn't even a thousandaire.
Right.
You know, he's a working cat in the middle of the country. So it's the neoliberalism of education. Maybe that's another show we should do, Pascal.
Listen, I'm going to have to run.
We should wrap this up. It's been almost 2 hours.
This is fantastic, but I actually have to finish cleaning the house. but this is great, and I really, really appreciate this discussion, and I hope you'll have me back sometime.
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. I have your information now, so we're definitely going to bring you back on. Excellent. Thank you so much for taking the time with us, Bill. Wherever you guys are watching this or listening to this, there should be links in the description to your organization, which is?
Campaign to End the Moroccan Occupation of Western Sahara, which is at freewesternsahara.org. We're also on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And I think we just got onto TikTok. So look us up.
See Bill Fletcher TikTok soon. Which dance are you going to do?
Don't get me started.
All right. Have a good rest of your day, Bill. Thank you so much.
Okay, you too. Brothers, take care.
Thank you. All right. That is Bill Fletcher, longtime labor activist in general, author. What'd you think, Pascal?
Great show.
Before we go, I do want to read some of these super chats. We had a few super chats. Thank you very much, Christopher Cotton. Great information, analysis, and perspective. Much appreciated. Thank you so much. Shot back with, wish I had more to give. Keep this message going. Goddamn, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's the kind of thing that allows us to keep this message going. Like, all jokes aside, you guys have no idea. I don't know how much 20 ILSs is, but Dusty sends us a bunch of flags. I think, is that the Western Sahara flag? Because it's similar to the Palestinian flag.
That might be.
I think it's Western Sahara flag. Thank you so much, Dusty. I'm going to assume 20 ILS is like $2,000. In my mind, I'm going to think that. That's okay. It's all that matters. I'm going to use the secret. Uncommon Sense 23. That's a very funny name. I always appreciate the content. Free the people. Thank you so much. And Mercutio. I'm really loving these TIR back-to-back billings, Bill Cody and now Bill Fletcher Jr. Would certainly like to see Bill on a future TIR show. Oh, don't worry. We're going to have him back. And I want to say shout out to Billy Button for hooking this up, because Billy asked me to be a part of a panel that was going to inform influencers. I don't like that title because I don't see myself as an influencer. I'm just a show host. That's all I am. About Western Sahara. And that's where I officially met Bill Fletcher on this panel. So thank you so much, Billy, and I'll give you a hug for this in real life when we see you in D.C. in 8 weeks. Is it like 8 weeks, Pascal?
Sounds correct. Might be less.
Okay. Is there anything you have planned for this weekend, brother?
I'm actually doing reading for our show in D.C.
Well, we got that show next week about C.L.R. James. So,
yep.
That is pretty important. People always want us to put a reading list together. Man. I think I may have to do something to appease people. We've tried numerous times to have posts, but I think we'll have to put something together of what we're all reading or working on at the moment. What do you think?
At some time, man.
And you know what? This is all your fault, by the way.
I know, because I suggest too many books on the show.
You do. You do. And you just fire them off. You just fire them off. Oh, you got to read this, this, this. You got to read this, this, that, and the third. It's your fault. How about this? You guys, I've just wrote a piece. It's out in Sublation. It's called The Ballad of O.J. O.J. Simpson is America's real-life Bigger Thomas. Go read Native Son and tell me what you think. Read the introduction to the Black Metropolis. Thank you so much to Ray Reed for sending that. He literally took pictures of it for me and sent it over because he felt that it was important for the article that I was writing to read this critique that Richard Wright has of his character of Bigger Thomas. And Pascal said something very appropriate the other day. What did you say? He said it felt like the white man's gaze into inner city Black life when you read Native Son. So, yeah, read those two things and let us know in the comments what you think about those things. And we'll start there. There's our reading list for the day. Native Son and the intro to the Black Metropolis. That's pretty good, huh, Pascal?
It's a good start, man.
It's a good start. And on that note, we are out. I'll be back Tuesday. I get to do the best of, you know, was 1984 the best year of music for metal and punk? So it'll be just me. Maybe some friends will join me. But thank you, Pascal, for hanging out. Thank you guys for watching. And we are
out.
Peace.